lernen ein bisschen Geschichte. Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte, dann werden Sie sehen, der Reporter, wie das sich damals entwickelt hat. Wie das sich damals entwickelt hat.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Geschichten aus der Geschichte. My name is Richard and today I have a special guest, and it's a special guest some of you may actually know because she's been a special guest with us before. Welcome Dr. Emma Southern.
Hi, it's good to be back. Can't believe it's been 2 years since the last time I was here. Just time flies.
It really does. And the last time you were here, we were talking about a book of yours. And today, we're going to be talking about a book of yours.
Yeah.
But let me just introduce you a bit more, because you are a writer and you also are a podcaster. You do a podcast called History is Sexy. You do it with Janina Mathewson. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Good. And it's a very good podcast. I enjoy listening to it. I think the last episode I listened to was the one about pirates. I think it's been a while, but that is the latest one I listened to. It's very interesting.
I didn't know we knew so much about pirates until I researched that. That's right. One of the... And how horrible being a pirate sounds.
Well, one could imagine, you know.
Suppose if you thought about boats for too long.
Generally not that much fun. But
yeah, the films make it look much nicer than it seemed to be.
Yeah, well, if you enjoy killing and pillaging. So looks very nice to me. So you do this podcast and yes, you wrote a book about which we talked 2 years ago, and that book was Agrippina, Empress, Exile, Hustler, Whore. The British title, I think they had to kind of tone it down for the US version.
They did. No, I was going to say, but that's okay. I always assume that somebody would take that out of the title anyway. So.
Oh, well. It's the one you're stuck with here and in our podcast as well. The episode was episode 183, and we released a full version of the interview 3 days later. And it's still an episode where we still get very good comments about and good feedback, so people really like it.
Ah, that's nice.
Anyway, today we are here to not talk about Agrippina, but about your new book. And your new book is called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Murder in Ancient Rome.
Yeah.
Now, the last couple of years saw a huge surge of podcasts, and I think half of those podcasts came.
True
crime podcasts. So I think you're really going with the zeitgeist here.
Yeah, that's how the book came about, to be honest, because I was talking about true crime podcasts with a friend of mine, and, you know, the appeal of true crime in general. And one of the things that we both find really interesting about kind of murders and serial killers and horrible events that happen in today's world is the insight that they give us into the cultures that we live in and the cultures of the recent past of the 20th century. And how certain types of murder can happen in certain contexts, and certain types of murder can be allowed to happen, and some are considered to be much worse than other types, and how that gives you a really interesting insight into the culture and the time. And I thought, oh, I bet someone's written a really good book about this from a Roman context and kind of Roman crime and Roman murder and what it tells us about the Romans, and it turned out that no one had, so I decided that I would write it just so that I could research it.
Yeah, someone has to do it, so
yeah. And it turns out that it really does tell us a lot about Roman culture and how Romans thought about life and death and who is important and who is not important, and when violence is okay and when it's not, mm-hmm. and how that changes over the centuries. And it ended up being really interesting.
I can attest to that. I mean, I read it and it's a very interesting book. You divided it in various subchapters. So you have like the first subchapter is on the Senate floor, and then you have things like family and marriage, or when you kill an emperor. So you already did some division into different types of murders there.
Yeah.
Which I find really interesting because, like, on the surface, obviously it's about a murder, but like you said earlier, it really gives you this insight into so many different things. I mean, you mentioned the, and I'm talking specifically about your book now. you mentioned the culture, but in many of your episodes that you detail in the book, you get insight into the states, into the machinations of the powerful,
yeah,
or the not so powerful, or those who want to be powerful, etc. So I think to me, this obviously on the surface it's about murder, but really it's about people, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. And that's, you know, murder at the end of the day, it's how we morally define one person killing another person. And that is a very intimate act between two people that occurs, and what drives somebody to do that and why they do it. And then what happens afterwards are all basically about human desires. And it turns out that they're largely the same. Mm-hmm. Selfishness and greed and a desire to get away with something.
So what would you say is special about murder in ancient Rome when you compare it to, let's say, the plethora of true crime that you have about the 20th century in our society?
The main thing that immediately leaped out to you when you're looking at it is that when we look at true crime or look at crime in the 20th, 21st century, it's always through the frame of civilians and police. And it is the responsibility of the police to solve crimes and prosecute them. And there is this whole structure of the state which exists to enter people's largely domestic private disputes, because most murders are over something personal, and to enter those and then turn them into a state matter and be interested in them and resolve them to the satisfaction of everybody. And in the Roman world, that just doesn't exist. There is no separate state apparatus with the responsibility to resolve stuff. It is an entirely self-help society, which means if you want to resolve something like a murder, then it is up to you and your extended circle of family and friends to resolve it. And if you have access to the structures of the state, so if you have access to the courts, or if you have access to your local governor, then you can ask them to make a decision about what should happen. But they're never going to come and send someone to deal with it for you. And what that means is that so much of everyday crime and murder, calling it crime is wrong, because what that means is that for a large proportion of the Roman world, for the pretty much the entire Republic, it's not technically a crime to kill somebody, because it's not something that the state legislates against. It is a personal, interpersonal issue that the family deals with, and that is dealt with on a personal, private level. So it's technically not a crime. It's not exactly encouraged, but it's not something that the state has any interest in whatsoever. And it's not until you start getting structures which center around a single person that they start trying to really erode away that privacy of the family and turn it into a more public institution, and also start to control who can commit violence, that it becomes a more of a crime. But even then, there is no state apparatus which is going to come in and do it. And there's nobody taking notes on who is killing who. It is entirely a matter for you to deal with as an individual. And so we only see the crimes that really, really cause an enormous disturbance in the fabric of society. Crimes which are either really, really scandalous or really, really grotesque in some way, or that genuinely impress people to such an extent that someone writes them down. Or we see them where people have managed to leave a little mark on, mostly on tombstones, where people will say, "This is a tombstone of my daughter who was murdered." And so you get to see like that tiny little bit of justice that they got. But there is no overarching sense that violence and murder is something that the Roman government is involved in, and no one seems to think that they should be either.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it is somewhat connected to sort of a feeling that people who are not part of the 1% are somewhat dispensable?
Yes, it is. It's partly that. There's two things that come together. Partly it's that everything in Rome is underpinned by slavery. From the very beginning, it is underpinned by slavery and people who have been brought in from outside, who are mostly have been captured in war and been stripped of their humanity. They are what is called socially dead. They are already dead, basically. And they are not seen as people. And then as the empire grows, as Rome gets richer, the whole thing is economically and practically underpinned by just millions of enslaved people who are ground up by the Roman Empire. And they are everywhere, but they are not people. Legally or morally, you cannot harm a slave in the same way that you can hurt a person, because they don't have anything attached to them worth hurting. You hurt a slave in the same way that you hurt a table. Like, it just doesn't register. It just doesn't register on a moral level that they're particularly people. And once you have that, where you can stand next to a person for your whole life, you can raise them from a child, because a lot of people were born in slavery, but see them as property, then that automatically means that you have had to find a way to apply meaning to human life that is not related to the fact that they're just a human. Like, they know that they're people, they know that they're human, they know they have feelings and hurt themselves, but in order to make it so that it is okay for those people to be killed and beaten and enslaved, you have to say that therefore life is worth something because it has something else. And what they have is fama, which is like your reputation and honor. So your prestige. So mm-hmm. like what other people say about you and your function and importance to the wider society. And the more of that you have, the more your life is worth. So a consul is worth more than an aedile, who is worth more than an equestrian, who is worth more than your random bookseller on the street, who is always worth more than a slave. And you have that. And then on the other hand, you have the fact that Rome is fundamentally a set of tribes, basically, like big family units who all work together and intermarry, but are connected by obligation and counter-obligation and feud. And that is where most of the dealings of life go on, is at that level of families talking to families rather than at a political or state level.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Republican period, certainly, up until Augustus, nobody wants to mess with that. And Augustus starts to change it by interfering with the family a bit. But it takes a long time for that structure, that tribal kind of structure, to break down into more individual concerns, whereby the state can be involved in an individual's behaviour rather than the father or a kind of a group of elder men being responsible for your behaviour.
Mm-hmm. What you said about the tribes and the families being sort of the one thing you basically live for, right? Or
yeah.
Let's say the fama, you have and your honour and your family. So these are the two things, like honour on an individual level and family on a less individual level. So you always want to further the fame of your family and your own, correct?
Yeah. So if you get to be a consul, then you then get to pass that down to your children and your grandchildren, that they are now the children and grandchildren of a consul. And if your great grandfather was a consul, then you can haul that family mask out at any given time. And you get special favor because your great grandfather was a consul, and now you have to try and live up to him. And that's all interconnected down the line, going back generations forever. And that, I think, is often overlooked when you look at Roman culture, that the importance of the clan and the gens, and individual, and how the individual works within that. And when it comes to things like murder, it is a kind of a closed ranks thing. If your son kills somebody, then you're not going to want that broadcast to the world because that is something that, you know, infamia is also going to follow you down the generation. So you're going to close ranks, you're going to try and deal with it on a person to person, family to family level, and hope that nobody else finds out too much about it.
Which is interesting when you're talking about how important it is to keep the family intact and to keep it intact for your children, because in your first chapter you write about Publius Claudius Pulcher, who basically let himself be adopted by another family so he could become a tribune.
Yeah, he does. He gives up the Claudian name, like one of the most ancient and prestigious patrician names that connects him back, God knows how many generations back to Publius Claudius Pulcher's, going back 400 years. It's so that he could become a plebeian, so that he could become the tribune of the plebs, which gave him veto over the Senate and meant that he could kind of build up his own little cult of personality. And it's a really interesting point because it's one of the first times that in this late Republican period, somebody is doing something for themselves, not for any great familial glory, but just because they want this immediate personal gain that they can get in this lifetime, and they don't care at all about the repercussions for their family or their repercussions for their hypothetical future children.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because I wasn't aware of the extent of the family being sort of this factor of identification, and what a huge scandal it must have been to just give up that name, especially one as big as that
Claudius one. Is like a walking scandal, to be fair. Like everything he does, and his sister as well, who is very close to Claudia, they are just a walking scandal. Everything they do, he dresses up as a woman so that he can break into a female only religious rite. He just lies openly to people. He then starts his own paramilitary. He is a nasty piece of work, but
yeah, I mean, it's how you described him. You were like, you wouldn't like him, but you're in awe of him being this anecdote machine.
Yeah, he is an anecdote machine because everything he does is extraordinary. And he wouldn't, if he was a politician and I had to live under him, I would absolutely hate him. And I would, you know, be writing letters to my MP about him constantly. But he's just such a kind of cape swirling, obvious villain who doesn't really seem to care what anybody thinks of him at all. And will do anything for the adulation of the kind of people of Rome, including giving up being a patrician. He leads, like, the period of his power is a period of just people dying in the streets because they're being beaten so that they will vote in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, hugely bloody and violent and horrendous. But from the distance of 2,000 years, you can look back and just be like, my God.
Yeah, I mean, that is what is afforded to us by history, you know.
It is. If after a few couple of hundred years, you can really look back and appreciate.
It's like bad form if you laugh about someone who died yesterday. But if you laugh about someone who died 2,000 years ago, it's like, okay,
yeah,
it's just fine. A funny episode. know?
There's a line somewhere where it becomes okay to find it funny.
Right. Since you were talking about these violent mobs, should we dive into the beginning of your book where you talk about murder on the Senate floor? And I'd love to talk about this first episode you wrote about Tiberius Gracchus, because there were riots in this story as well, not with armed gangs as with Claudius. But still, there was quite a bit of rioting going on, or brawling going on. Would you mind just giving a quick rundown of who Tiberius Gracchus was? Because from what I got, there's not too much to say about him that is as funny or as interesting, apart from the fact that he was involved in this murder, which, you know, was his own. in the end.
Yeah, so he is a politician in the about 130 BCE. He is a from a plebeian but extremely extremely ancient family. Mm-hmm. And particularly on his from his mother's side, they're patrician, they're the Cornelii, they're the Scipios. They have conquered Carthage and done all kinds of things. They're very important. And he is the older of two sons. And he becomes very interested in land reform. This is why I say that he is one of the more boring members of his family. The rest of his family are worlds of anecdotes. But he becomes very and genuinely interested in land reform. And land reform is something which has bothered the Romans since pretty much the beginning of the Republic, or certainly mm-hmm. since they started expanding, whereby rich people have been buying up Italy. As they have conquered more and more of Italy, the rich have bought it up. And what they are supposed to be doing is giving it to landless people. And they have often been stealing it from the state, stealing it from one another, stealing it from things which are supposed to be rented to poor people so that they can rent a couple of acres of land. The land barons basically have rented it to themselves in perpetuity. And it's been a problem that's been going on for a good 300 years and has come up, and people have said, we need to take this land. The government needs to basically have an amnesty, take all the land back, and then redistribute it. And it has been constantly unpopular amongst the Senate and very, very popular amongst the kind of disenfranchised of Rome and of Italy, because there's a lot of people throughout Italy who've basically had the Romans show up over the past few hundred years, steal all their stuff, steal all their land, and leave them with nothing. So this comes up every time it's ended with somebody being tried, with it being voted down. Tiberius brings it up again, and he becomes the tribune of the plebs. And the tribune of the plebs is a position which is supposed to speak for the rights of the plebeians against the patricians.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just so people know what we're talking about here, anyone who's not familiar. So you have the plebeians and you have the patricians, and the patricians are the old rich families, and the plebeians somewhat not as rich, not as old.
It's basically a status signifier whereby the patrician families are those who were originally chosen to be part of Romulus's court, so his set of advisors. So they descend from the very beginning of Rome, and then other people have been granted patrician status along the way for specific things, but they are they're like the aristocracy, the ancient aristocracy. And they wear like special shoes, and they get like extra colours and special rings and stuff, which denotes their status. Mm-hmm. And there was a big, what's called the conflict of the orders, whereby the patricians had everything in terms of power and the plebeians had nothing. So there was an uprising, and the tribune of the plebs was instituted to be the spokesperson for the plebeians in the for the Senate. And they have the right to override the Senate, and they have all kinds of special privileges. Mm-hmm. Now, Tiberius Gracchus is more interested in land reform than his previous people, the previous people who have attempted to do it. And he is willing to use his power to force it through in a way that previously people haven't. And he proposes a bunch of things like commissions in order to learn who owns everybody's all of the land, take it all in, and then divvy it up so that everybody owns pretty much exactly the same amount of land. So everybody gets about 350 acres, which is a massive jump for a lot of people, but a massive cut for a lot of others. And the Senate, there is a there's an economic barrier to being in the Senate. You have to have a certain amount of money, like a million sesterces. So you have to, you literally have to be amongst the 1% in order to be in the Senate. It's self-selectingly, the richest people in Rome have all of the power. And what occurs is a series of votes that Tiberius tries to put through that continually devolve because the Senate and other tribunes keep intervening. So like he will call a vote and people flood in from Italy in order to vote in these things, because basically someone said to them, would you like some free land? And they're like, would you like to come and vote on whether you can have some free land?
I think in your book, you you called it, he bust in people.
Yeah. they, you know, they were rounding people up to bring them in to vote. And on the other side, all of the richer side of Rome is hanging around in their dinner parties. A lot of this land has been in their families for generations. You know, they've got it in a dowry. They've inherited it from their grandfather. They've bought it legally off of somebody who inherited it from someone else. And as far as they're concerned, this is land that means something to them, that's been in their family for generations, and now Tiberius is going to come and take it away. So it's very, very fraught. And this is all occurring at a time when Rome is richer than it's ever been before. And where it's starting to absorb territory by osmosis, basically. People are so terrified of the Romans in the east, mostly, that when they die, they are handing their territory over to the Romans so that their people won't have to suffer a Roman siege or the Roman army entering. So they, at this point, they get Pergamon. And so tensions are very, very high and Rome is very, very rich and everybody wants something out of it. There's a few votes which have to be called off because they just descend into chaos. People won't let the votes go through. People bring violence in until the final vote occurs. It is, in fact, Tiberius is running for re-election and they've basically managed to put him off for a full year. He's now running for re-election. The vote, which is happening kind of in the Campus Martius, is going very badly, as it has been for the entire previous year. But it looks like Tiberius is going to win. As the votes come in, people vote orally, singularly, like, and they're totting up and it looks like Tiberius is going to win. The Senate, meanwhile, is holding an emergency meeting in a temple and are discussing what they're going to do about it. Because if Tiberius gets through, if he has another mandate to do his land redistribution, then there's a very distinct possibility that he genuinely is going to take their land away.
Yeah.
And they start suggesting that maybe they just murder him. And that would solve all of their problems.
Mm-hmm. Before we go on from here, because we are reaching sort of the culmination of that tale already, one thing I'd just like for you to clarify, because you do it so well in the book, Tiberius Gracchus, he didn't just do this out of the kindness of his heart, right?
Oh,
I mean,
no.
there was a need for land distribution.
There isn't, because what you have is a whole lot of people who are very disenfranchised and who genuinely have had everything taken away from them, who are either living on rented land or who are living like on no land. And the other issue that you have is that at this point, the Roman army still technically requires people to be landowners and also promises people land when they come out of the army.
It's a bit of a catch 22, isn't it? you're promised land, but you have to have land in order to even serve.
The deal is that if you serve in the army, then you will be given some land of your own once you come out. So you serve, you're like, I think it's quite short at this time. It's 16 years by the time you get to Augustus, but it's definitely shorter than that here. But you serve your time and then you can leave. You can have some Italian land. You can settle down and you can be secure. And there is no land to give people right now. They're giving away land in other places, but a lot of Roman citizens don't want to be going off and living in Pergamon.
Right.
So there is very much a need for both the people of Rome and for the armies of Rome to the city has land to give people. And also so much of Italian land is being taken up now by pleasure rather than farmland, because it's being owned by a limited number of people. They are using that land primarily for things like wine and for their own pleasure gardens and mm-hmm. their private land rather than using it for food. And Italy is losing the ability to feed itself. And this is a long time before they get Egypt and the breadbasket. Mm. So there is a desperate need for them to be able to grow stuff as well. If they can have a population that feeds itself, then that's a benefit to everybody. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you tell that to somebody that you want to take away their pleasure garden and give it to 25 soldiers so that they can grow some subsistence vegetables, and they did not take it particularly well.
Oh, of course.
The long-term ramifications did not, they did not really care.
I mean, it's interesting because the way you framed it earlier was that a lot of those people who owned or had this land, for some reason or another, they had this sense of entitlement, right? It was not that they, most of them probably didn't even think there's something wrong about them occupying that land.
Basically, they, as far as they were concerned, it was land that had come to them legitimately. Like, we're well past the period where Italy has been conquered. So it's been 250 years odd since most of this land was taken by the Romans and since it has been entering Roman families. And so it's been generations worth of this land being passed around. And as far as each individual sitting in the Senate is concerned, this is land that belongs to them. It belongs to their wife. Their grandfather gave it to them. They bought it legitimately from Rufus down the road. And so as far as they're concerned, it's like someone's going to come into your house and take away your Xbox. and they're furious about it. It's not just that they're taking away their money, because land is like the basis of so much of wealth, especially within Italy. Italian land is much like owning property in like New York or London. It is of astronomical value. And so it's not just taking away their wealth, but it's also taking away something that belongs to them, that is theirs, that they're granddad once used 1,000 slaves to farm, and now they use 1,000 slaves to farm it. And so it is very much, they do very much feel like he is trying to snatch something out of their hands, like take their family jewels or steal their firstborn child.
And I mean, that again plays into the whole got to keep the family name intact and big and whatnot. And if you suddenly, your wealth is slashed because half or two-thirds or whatnot of your land is taken away, then that has an impact on the farmer of your family, right?
Yeah, you know, and it's potentially going to impact people's right to be in the Senate as well. If you need a certain amount of money in order to be in there and the land is capped in that, then and for people who are hanging on the edge, if you take away half their land, then potentially you're knocking them out of the Senate.
Right. So the whole issue was huge for everyone. I mean, it's not like just one new law or something. It's like it would have been a formative law, would have changed the whole political landscape as well.
And changed the landscape of the whole of Italy.
Yeah, like the literal landscape.
The literal landscape. And would be a really big deal. It would change Rome. It would change Italy. It would change the lives of thousands of people. It would undermine the wealth inequality that exists in Rome, whereby a small number of people have an awful lot and a lot of people have absolutely nothing.
Right.
And, you know, and this is a place where they haven't introduced the corn dole yet, but they're about to, because they literally have to feed people who are starving to death in the streets because that's not possible for people to feed themselves, really. So it's super emotive, and it is a time when we are teetering into violence being a part of Roman politics as usual. And this starts in the when elections are going on, where everybody goes down and lines up in their sentries and then walks in to cast their vote, and everybody has to go down and spend the whole damn day hanging out in a field to vote and listen to a load of speeches. And that often, because when you've got thousands of people in a hot field listening to speeches, voting on emotive issues, that often turned into shoving and pushing, and then that often became quite violent. And during this time, as we enter the late Republic, it starts to become deliberately violent, where people are deliberately provoking, like people in the Senate are deliberately provoking violence amongst the voters, which is how stuff is kicking on in the initial votes. So the votes for the commission, which passes, and then votes for various other things that Tiberius tries to pass, that they become very violent. And that's how the Senate is stopping them from passing. And sometimes they kick off by themselves because there's two tribunes and they can veto one another. So his other tribune quite regularly will step forward and say, no, don't speak, I veto. And then the people in the crowd who came all this way to vote will kick off.
Yeah.
but this is ways in which the whole thing has been leading towards violence becoming an everyday part of Republican politics. And the point at which Tiberius is at this point for Tiberius's election is the point at which it then takes a step up into the highest echelons. And it's not just senators and the elite provoking violence amongst people who don't matter, whose names will never be remembered. It is them sitting in a temple talking about whether the easiest way to deal with this problem is going to be to kill Tiberius, mm-hmm. and for them to do it.
And that's new.
Yes.
So that has not happened like that before. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, we all have this, or not we all, you obviously don't because you're the expert, but generally, when people think back to Roman times and they think of these stories, you get this feeling that, you know, it's always been kind of like that. If you didn't like someone, you just killed him. Even if it was like a big political figure. But as with everything, it had to start somewhere. And you say that this is basically the point where it becomes okay in the higher or upper echelons to talk about killing a political adversary.
Yeah. Before this, you could, like, there are ways in which you can legally have somebody executed. And it's super easy in the early Republic and into the mid Republic to say that somebody wants to be a king and then have them executed for it. And that happens a fair amount. And they try to do that to Tiberius. They accuse him of wanting to be a king, which basically means people like him too much.
Yeah.
But that doesn't go anywhere, much to everybody's frustration, probably because he is very clearly not interested in being a king. He is genuinely and very tediously interested in land reform.
Yeah, nobody really believes that he wants to be king, right?
No, exactly. It just can't, like, he's so staid and serious and...
I mean, he's no Caesar. I mean, with Caesar, no. It's like, okay, I can believe it.
Or even his brother, because his brother Gaius comes later, and his brother Gaius spends all of his time, like, flinging his toga off his shoulder and slapping his thigh and making ludicrous pronouncements. And he has a musician who follows him everywhere to play thematic music for him, which is great.
Well, your life soundtrack, you need it.
I know, it's just what everyone's always wanted. But Tiberius is like the staid older brother. He's very serious. He's always trying to be reasonable. Like throughout all of this, he's always trying to explain to people why it's good for them. But he, you know, why it's good for Rome in general, why it's good for the glory of Rome that we can do this. So it's just unconvincing that he wants to be king. And so they can't get rid of him that way. They can't get him on anything treasonous. They can't get him on any of the ways that they would previously have got rid of somebody. So they end up talking about, and somehow, you know, somebody says for the first time, why don't we just kill him? And this happens in a Senate meeting, an official Senate meeting in a religious space. And the consul says, no, we can't do that. You can't just go around killing people. That's mental. And they argue about the situation. The Pontifex Maximus is pushing really hard for the idea. So he's like the head priest of Rome. He is, the idea is that he takes the place of a king, if a king were to exist, to do like the religious duties of the king. So the most important religious duties of Rome are the Pontifex Maximus. It's technically a kind of political position because you get mm-hmm. elected to it, but it is also a very religious position. So it is a bit like the Pope suddenly deciding that he wants to murder somebody.
Okay. I mean, it's not unheard of.
Popes are pretty great. But they're having this conversation, they're going back and forth. The consul is really against it. And in order for it to be legal, basically, they would need the consul to say that he was guilty of something. Mm-hmm. But they are so hyped up and so emotional over the situation and so afraid that they just stand up, and the Pontifex Maximus stands up and says, as the consul is a traitor to the whole emperor and he won't protect Rome, I will. And mm-hmm. they tear their benches apart and he shouts, let anyone who wants to save the country come with me. And the senators march out of the temple and march up to where the election for Tiberius is once again in chaos, and they chase him and his friends across the Capitoline Hill and beat him to death with wood.
Hmm. And they did that because they weren't allowed to take their swords with them into the Senate.
Yeah. So they're not allowed, they don't have any swords. So they're too impatient to wait, and they are absolutely desperate for it to be over immediately. As they see them coming, it starts basically a stampede. People are trampled to death. People are violently beaten with chair legs and bits of wood. And Tiberius falls down at the feet of the statues of the ancient kings and is just beaten to death by the Senate, the richest and most austere, and the people in charge of running the whole empire. And they do it in a frenzy of pure rage, essentially. It's not an assassination of any kind. It is a pure rage-fueled, like, storming and getting rid of him in the most brutal way they possibly could.
So the way you said it just earlier about the pontifex saying, okay, we got to kill him because he's trying to destroy Rome, etc.
Yeah.
Do you think they actually believed that? Destroy the fabric of the empire, the fabric of the republic with this reform?
I think they probably did, yeah. I think that they were like so invested in the structure of Rome as it worked, mm-hmm. whereby a lot of people had everything and a lot of people had nothing. And that they also have this very strong belief that the aristocracy are just better. Like that kind of very ancient idea that you get in fantasy novels, that members of the aristocracy, their blood is literally better than everybody else's.
Yeah, I mean, we have that now, you know. It's not,
yeah, I mean, I live in
alien
the UK where it's very...
as an idea. I mean, obviously not as prevalent as it was back then, but the idea still exists.
Yeah, and you see, you know, I live in, as I said, in the UK. Our government is currently run by people who are primarily from landed aristocracy generations past, and people vote for them quite happily because they're extremely posh, and there is a general belief that very people who are landed aristocracy probably just know how to run things better.
Yeah.
And they seem to believe it very strongly too.
Yeah, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy here, you know.
It is. Nobody else gets a go.
They wouldn't be in power if they weren't, you know, good
yeah,
at it.
If they weren't so good at it. And evidence be damned. But yeah, so they do have that belief, and you know, this is how it's been since Romulus. And this and another thing about Romans is that they're very into antiquity. Old things are by their very nature good. The older something is, the gooder it is. And so if Romulus wanted patricians and a Senate, and if this is how it's always been, then you can't change it. That would be ridiculous. And changing things is inherently bad, no matter how no matter what you are changing. They only change things if they can trick themselves into believing that they're changing it back to how it was. So that's very ingrained in them as well. The idea of changing something ancient is anathema. So I suspect that they did genuinely believe that they were doing the right thing. And the next day and the days after Tiberius's murder, when you think they might be maybe wake up in their beds and think, oh my God, what did we do? They double down quite hard on what they did. They defile Tiberius's body and throw it in the river. They then exile and execute a bunch of his friends and just basically try to make it so that land reform is never going to come up again, because this is what is going to happen. And they basically convince themselves and write it into the consequences that they did the right thing. They protected the Republic. He was a traitor and a threat to the Republic, and therefore he had to die. And what that did was it made it so that as long as you said, oh, I'm protecting the Republic, and possibly if you even believed that you were protecting the Republic, killing someone in the political arena could be legitimate. You could have a cast iron defence that said, yes, I killed him off the bat with no trial by myself, with a stick, but he was threatening the Republic, so
that kind of paved the way for the next centuries, right? Or decades at least.
Yeah, until you, Nick, right the way down to that's the reasoning that is used by Brutus and Cassius and other Brutus when they kill Caesar, and that's their reasoning for not killing Antony is, well, we're protecting the Republic. And it's the reasoning that Cicero uses when he executes Catiline without a trial, that he is protecting the Republic. And everyone says, do you have any, got any evidence? And he says, no, you can't have a look at it. I did it last night. I've lost it. That's definitely why I did it.
Would you say that the situation that kind of culminated in the murder of Tiberius, do you think it would have come to something similar anyway, so that, something like the murder of Caesar would have happened anyway? Or would you say that without Tiberius, probably the murder of Caesar wouldn't have happened in the way it did? I mean, obviously that's conjecture, because there were, a few steps in between, and Caesar probably wouldn't have existed if things went differently back then.
But yeah,
would you say
It does. I think it does pave the way for the murder of Caesar, because it is the first time that kind of assassination of senator on senator violence in such a way, and they justify it to themselves and to everyone who is watching. And that then sets you on the path for what happens to Caesar. Otherwise, what you have is a path of trials and exiles, and it was never going to be possible to try or exile Caesar. And I suspect that without the legacy of justified political violence that grows in the late Republic, if Caesar is not assassinated, then Caesar just makes himself a king.
So since you mentioned exile and you mentioned that the next day after Tiberius was killed, they had friends of his or family even killed as well. Would you say that this was done so people wouldn't try to take revenge for the murder of Tiberius? Sort of like what people did when someone was murdered.
Basically, they do it so there can be no other place for that populism to coalesce around. Like, there can be nobody else that can take up his mantle.
But there happened to be another one doing it, right?
There was. They didn't, as there's always overlooked someone, and they overlooked his brother.
Which is kind of a rookie mistake, isn't it? I mean, it's his brother.
Yeah. You'd think it was obvious, but his brother was very young, and it takes a decade for Gaius to enter the political arena and try to kind of take up his brother's mantle. Mm-hmm. And he's much more fiery and is much less reasonable. And he basically, at the first sign of dissent, tries to lead a coup against the Senate like a military coup, which does not last very long at all. Because as soon as he has done that, he has cast himself, like he literally is an enemy of the Republic then. Mm-hmm. There's no backing away from it. And so they just send soldiers in who behead him and everybody he knows. And they treat it as a violent attempt to overthrow the Republic, which is a shame because he could, had he been a bit more reasonable, something different could have happened. But he is, he's considerably less patient than his brother.
Mm-hmm.
But it is another incident 10 years later with largely the same people still around, where, again, they have to kill somebody in order to... And they chase him down and cut his head off, and then they bring his head back, and the person who brought it back gets its weight in gold. But they, you know, they hunt him down, they behead him, they bring it back, and it's another time very soon after where they can say, this guy threatened the Republic, so we killed him. We didn't put him on trial. We didn't do anything, you know, legal around the situation. We just, we went and dealt with it.
Mm-hmm. So Tiberius is dead. His brother is dead. End of this story. But one thing that I'd like to talk about at the end is the sources, because you mentioned details about, you know, the killing of Tiberius, like that he falls to the feet of the ancient kings and the way he's bludgeoned to death, etc., etc. How reliable are these sources that you're taking, you know, this information from? Or can we even talk about reliable in that context?
It's tough to talk about reliable with the Romans. But there are two big sources for Tiberius and Gaius who are Plutarch. They're both writing a long time later and are actively baffled by the Republic, really, and how Roman Republic works. They are writing in a time when there has not just been emperors, but there's been emperors for 200 years, and it is basic. And the word Caesar means emperor. And so but it's quite interesting because you can see where they are trying to honestly write out what their sources are telling them, because they say, I don't understand why this happened. So when they write about the debate about whether they should kill Tiberius while the Senate are all sitting around in the temple, Appian is really baffled as to why they don't just make somebody a dictator and then he could do it legally. And why they don't just make somebody into like a mini emperor, basically. He's just really baffled. And that just that, like, you can't just do that in the Republic. But so it's Appian and Plutarch. Appian writes a thing called the Civil Wars, which is effectively a long history of the collapse of the Roman Republic through all of the various wars. So coming out this one into the Social Wars with Marius and Sulla, and then into Pompey and and Plutarch, who wrote a series of biographies called The Parallel Lives, where he took figures from Greek history, classical Greek history, and figures from Roman history and kind of tried to match them up. So he wrote one of Tiberius Gracchus, which has a lot of the good details in it, because he likes a good detail.
Okay.
But they are writing, they're writing a long time after. And they're writing in a completely different context, and they are genuinely kind of baffled by what is occurring. But they do both write a really nice narrative, and it matches. So they're obviously drawing from the same sources, whatever they're drawing from. It's unusual for something to match reasonably well.
Just out of interest, I mean, obviously everything here is out of interest, but how or where would they get their sources from? I mean, are these sources that we just don't know about nowadays because they're lost, or would this be sort of oral tradition? Or
it is lost historians. We know the names of quite a lot of lost historians from various periods that people drew from, and they will often say, like, you know, X says Y, Marius says da da da, and Mauricius says da da da. But those are sadly lost. Like, Romans really loved writing histories about themselves. They enjoyed it a lot. Particularly, it was a great hobby for senators to sit around and write histories of their of themselves, much in the same way that it's really popular for historians of for British politicians to be historians of the Victorians, or, you know, Churchill or whatever. Like, they love to write a history of their own times and the times that they wish they lived in. But so much of it, because it's Latin, was lost in the Middle Ages. So we know who they were. We vaguely know sometimes when they existed, but they're unfortunately lost forever.
Mm-hmm. Would you, I mean, my academic focus was the early medieval period. So I'm like on the other side of the spectrum, because I have, like, for my thesis, I had two reliable sources, basically.
Yeah. I know that feeling.
Somewhat reliable sources. And what is it like for someone who does ancient Rome, like you do, and you have like this huge amount of material to choose from? How do you do it?
I tell you, it never feels like, it's only when you're dealing with this very narrow period that you have a huge amount of to deal with. There's like, and that's why that period is so well known, basically starting here with Tiberius through to the end of the Julio-Claudians is like a really well-known period, and that is really really well covered, and there's multiple sources for various things. Some of them are not, like Tacitus, for example, who we use for most of the Julio-Claudians, has big chunks missing, which is heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. But it's only that. And once you step out of the politics of the late Republic and early imperial system, then it's kind of wastelandy.
Oh, okay.
And it's much more like it is for you. But it is, it's nice when you get to do something like, so this is great for me, because I don't usually write about politics, and I certainly don't write about the politics of the late Republic. So I was having so much fun being like, I've got five sources for this, and mm-hmm. I can, and they basically agree with each other. This is amazing. So it feels like an embarrassment of riches. I don't know how you deal with much more than that. I always think this about 20th century historians, where they've got so much, like, how do you narrow it down?
All right. Emma, I've taken up a huge chunk of your time already. thank you so much. One thing that I just have to mention, because it's been going around my head all through actually reading that book and now talking to you, the historian Tom Holland, who blurbed your book as well.
Yeah.
He wrote this book, Dominion, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and in an interview... Yeah. He said something interesting, that people are actually, when they think of ancient Rome nowadays, with, you know, the Senate and political structures and all this stuff that is kind of like the basis for how we see sort of, you know, democracy, etc., they have this idea of this ideal idea of the Romans, and that actually, compared to the way we value life nowadays, it's really very barbarian, and that only the sort of Christianity or Christian morality kind of got us where we are nowadays, and people often don't really want to think about that without this we'd still be living in a time that is very similar to what you're describing in your book.
Yeah, it is. It is, like, when you look at the legal and moral like developments around human life, it is very much Christianity that starts to make people feel differently about it. And it's Constantine who brings in the first law that says you can't just kill a slave, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll never forget when I was an undergraduate, one of my lecturers, Mary Harlow, talking about the Romans and like the terrible things that they did, and then just saying, and yet they called other people barbarians.
Right.
Like, they will do all this stuff. They will crucify people in the street. They will have these monstrous things that they do to one another just as a matter of their political course. They will murder people in their houses on a distressingly regular basis. And then they're just getting cross about trousers. Like, but trousers is the line. That's the Germanic barbarian line.
Look at them. I mean, what kind of people must they be?
I know. They don't even, you know, murder people in the arena.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. As fascinating as your book is, and I'm just going to say the name again. It's called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. It's a very good book. What we talked about now was the first part of the first chapter. So
yeah.
You get an idea of the breadth of material that you can find in this book. I mean, you already know it. So talking about my audience here, they will. Thank you so much for joining me again for an episode.
It's my pleasure. When I write another one, I'll come back.
So it's going to be in about 2 years?
Yeah, probably.
Good. So March 2023. I suppose we'll still be around then.
I hope so.
Great. Well, thank you. And best of luck with, you said your book just came out in the US. So you're basically world famous with this book now as well, not just with
Agrippina. That's the aim, yeah.
Perfect. Okay. So thank you very much. And let's talk soon, 2023.
Okay. Thank you.
Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte. Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte, dann werden Sie sehen, Herr Reporter, wie das sich damals entwickelt hat. Wie das sich damals entwickelt hat.